From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Hello and welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Kim Lewis, and joining me on the panel this week are VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwara and VOA Executive Producer Steve Radish. Welcome, Patsy and Steve.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Here are the issues. China urged peace after a U.S. warning of serious consequences if it provided arms to support Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Washington and its NATO allies are scrambling to dissuade China from providing military aid to Moscow's war. In a surprise visit to Kyiv, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to reaffirm U.S. economic support and to announce the recent transfer of $1.25 billion in assistance. The U.S. and its allies are moving to treat Iran as a global threat, warning its growing alliance with Russia and cooperation in Ukraine means Tehran's destabilizing activities will pose a greater danger than ever before. The Supreme Court's conservative justices cast doubt on President Biden's debt forgiveness plan during oral arguments, hindering the administration's plan to wipe out more than $400 billion in student debt because of the emergency economic change of the coronavirus pandemic. Jill Biden returned from her visit to Africa as the U.S. First Lady. President Biden said she, quote, spoke to more than 1,000 young people, the first generation born out of apartheid in Namibia. In Kenya, she met families affected by devastating drought and food insecurity, made worse by Putin's brutal assault on Ukraine, and made it clear that America's commitment to Africa is real. That's from President Biden. And Afghanistan's government's watchdog for reconstruction revealed that the U.S. helped lay the groundwork for the quick fall of the country when U.S. troops left Afghanistan in August 2021. Well, those are the issues, and let's get started. Well, a year after Russia's invasion and bombing of Ukraine, China, Moscow's strategic partner, has taken a rare initiative into European problem solving by offering a 12-point position paper to end the conflict in Ukraine. What is the U.S. and its allies, what are they making of this from China?
President Biden is certainly saying that this is not a plan considered seriously. I think he was asked in an interview recently what he thought about the peace plan, and he said there's nothing in there that would benefit anybody other than Russia. So the White House is not considering this as a serious proposal. They are very much concerned in terms of the ties that appear to be growing closer between Beijing and Moscow. We know that there are rumors of a planned meeting between President Xi Jinping and President Putin as early as next week. We still haven't had that confirmation yet. But this is certainly a relationship that the West is paying attention very closely. This is something as well that the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz urged China not to send weapons to help Russia's war in Ukraine and instead asked Beijing to pressure Moscow to pull back its forces. So this is the same kind of message that the White House is trying to send out to China. This is another one of those, if you're helping Russia, then you're part of the problem instead of part of the solution, that kind of messaging that's coming out from the West.
China's peace plan was not rejected in whole by President Zelensky. He remarked that there are some things in the Chinese plan that made sense, but for the most part, it seems like the China peace plan is somewhat dead on arrival. Even Russia seems to have some issue with it. A Kremlin spokesman saying, for now, we don't see any of the conditions that are needed to bring the whole story toward peace. So while China seems to want to play peacemaker, as Patsy said, the United States sees this as something that is definitely tilting toward Russia and kind of rejected out of hand.
As Steve said, the rejection or kind of the cold shoulder from Russia is basically because the plan from Beijing does not recognize what they call new territorial realities in Ukraine. So it doesn't really mention what kind of settlement that the party should be working on. And I think this is key in terms of any kind of potential peace plan. And it just seems so far off into the future right now because of the issue of, you know, just where do we draw the lines? Do we include borders from 2014, which would include Crimea being returned to Ukraine or not? I mean, obviously, Ukraine is saying that what we want is all of our territories, including Crimea. And this may be just the issue that does not get settled. In terms of the future of even a potential peace plan, it may have to look like some sort of ceasefire where these territorial disagreements are left aside, where the parties stop their conflict without settling the issue of who has what, and rather focus on, you know, what kind of security guarantees does Ukraine receive from the West that would be acceptable to both Kyiv and Moscow. But again, this is very, very far off into the future. The White House has for many, many months now, maybe about 4 to 6 months, have stopped saying things like offering a diplomatic off-ramp to Putin, simply because they don't see at this point that Putin is looking for any kind of diplomatic off-ramp.
Also this week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov in India. What came out of this meeting?
Not a whole lot. It seems like it happened for about 10 minutes on the sidelines of the G20 ministerial meeting in Delhi. According to a State Department spokesman, Blinken stressed the need for a peaceful resolution of the war in Ukraine and a resolution that maintains territorial integrity. It's the first time that the two have spoken face-to-face in, it seems like, at least a year. They have spoken on the phone. There was a negotiation for the release of the U.S. basketball player, Brittany Griner, several months ago. So the two men have spoken, but certainly not for any length of time, and certainly not on anything that will result in something peaceful happening anytime soon.
The other two points that Blinken made to Lavrov was urging Russia to reverse its decision to pull out or to suspend participation in the New START nuclear treaty. This was something that happened just a few weeks ago. And, you know, this is concerning, but the White House has been kind of dismissing it, saying that, well, they didn't pull out entirely, but they did stop participation. This is, of course, in response to the U.S. sending more weapons to Ukraine. The other point that Blinken requested or made to Lavrov was that Moscow should release Paul Whelan. This is the other American that has been detained in Moscow.
Yes, it's a really good point. And President Biden marked the start of a second year of war in Europe by announcing billions of dollars in additional military aid for Ukraine and imposing more sanctions on those helping President Putin, and delivered a grim warning about an alliance between Russia and Iran. So what are Iran's intentions?
Iran's intentions seem to be the same thing as Iran's intentions for many years, which is to disrupt the regular process of how countries work with one another, and certainly trying to supply Russia with the kind of weapons that really disrupt day-to-day life. These drones that appear somewhat out of nowhere and can travel long distances with light payloads to deliver kind of surprising and out of the blue type of strikes that are not necessarily seen by radar that is looking for missiles coming from Russia or other kind of weaponry that might be coming over the transom.
Yeah, and I think what's notable about the developments in terms of what Iran is doing with Russia is the U.S. characterization of it, right? So I think earlier this week, Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Dana Shrull said that we are now at the point where Iran is threatening not just the Middle East, but has become a global challenge. Now, that's a shift because, you know, as of just a few months ago, U.S. officials are still looking at Iran as a regional threat, a regional menace, rather than a global challenge. So this is a departure of language, a ramping up of language from U.S. officials, including CIA director who called the relationship between Iran and Russia disturbing and moving very quickly in a very dangerous direction. So we'll see what comes out of it, but there's definitely a lot more scrutiny on Iran from U.S. administration officials, even though Iran continues to deny that it provides drones to Russia.
Yes, and as you say, we will have to continue to follow developments on that. Well, it's time now for a quick break, and later, U.S. First Lady Jill Biden leaves Africa on warm notes. Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference, USA, and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwara and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. Well, Steve, the U.S. Supreme Court, mostly conservative justices, posed the question during arguments over Biden's move to forgive $430 billion in student loan debt as an unlawful overreach of executive power. Is this something for Congress rather than the executive power of the president?
Chief Justice John Roberts raised that issue, whether it's right for President Biden and the executive branch to have so much power over so much money, since it's Congress's duty, constitutional duty, to decide how the money is spent. The Solicitor General, who argues on behalf of the White House in front of the Supreme Court, argued that Congress did indeed decide that question when it passed the HEROES Act back in 2003 that allowed the education secretary to have broad powers over lots of different money issues, including the power to forgive or to suspend payments for student loans. At the time, it was passed shortly after the 9/11 attacks. There was a lot of concern about Americans who were joining the military because of the 9/11 attacks, whether it was going to be a burden for these soldiers to pay back any student loans that they had. So Congress made this carve out in the HEROES Act that allowed the Secretary of Education to make these kind of decisions. So obviously it's a large amount of money. About 43.5 Americans have student loans, and that debt is more than $1.7 trillion. So the $400 billion in student loan debt that the Biden administration is trying to wipe out is probably about 25% of that. Maybe it's a little less than that of the $1.7 trillion in loans that have been taken out. The big issue here is the politics of it. Republicans have used the issue to cast the Democrats as elitist, favoring cancellation of student debt for higher educated Americans over those who either chose not to go to college or couldn't afford to go to college. President Biden, in his campaign in 2020 for the presidency, made a promise that he would do something about student debt. One of the results of that is that for the first time, more than half of the country's young people actually came out to vote in 2020. Whether it was because of student debt or not, the youth vote did come out. President Biden did win. And so he's trying to pay back that campaign promise that he made. Whether or not he succeeds, whether or not the Supreme Court makes this decision to overturn it or send it back to Congress or whatever, at least President Biden can say to these people that I promised, I came through, I tried. And I think that's the biggest issue in the court, other than the decision as to whether or not to go through with this. It's really about politics and appearances, as far as President Biden trying to reach out and touch younger Americans where it matters most in their pocketbook.
The only thing that I would add to that was the reaction from the White House that really underscores Steve's point about, you know, the fact that this is politics ultimately. They were asked by reporters, you know, what would happen to the 40 million or so Americans who are expecting for this to happen, have already planned their lives around, you know, the student debt being wiped out? What happens if it doesn't happen? And the White House is basically saying, well, you know, that was our plan. If it doesn't work, then we don't have a plan B. So it really is about, as Steve said, delivering a campaign promise. And obviously, A, if it works out, then that's fantastic. That's another win for the Biden administration. But if it doesn't happen, he can come off and say that at least we tried.
Well, Patsy, U.S. First Lady Jill Biden concluded her trips to Namibia and Kenya leaving a message of hope, as VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell wrote in her first-hand coverage of Biden's Africa trip. So Anita said she used hopeful words to address social issues plaguing the young and growing population there. So, Patsy, how would you summarize Biden's trip?
I think it was a good mix of this kind of message of warmth and hope and friendship that first ladies usually bring when they visit the African continent. And this is something that American first ladies traditionally do, not just Jill Biden before her, also Melania Trump, as well as Michelle Obama, Laura Bush, and so on. What Jill Biden did on her trip was she managed to bring substance as well as this message of warmth. She talked about education, which is something that she's very passionate about as somebody who still continues to teach in a community college here near Washington. She spoke about women empowerment. She brought her grandchildren to spotlight how women and girls can be powerful engines of change. So it was a trip that was not only covered for the fact that, you know, the first lady posed with local African activists and so on, but it also highlighted the Biden administration's attention to the continent. I would say that compared to past ladies' visit, for example, the Melania Trump visit that I covered back in 2018, where she highlighted her program, which was Be Best. That's her kind of education and anti-bullying platform. But she was mostly covered because of her fashion choices, right? I mean, you remember Melania Trump posing in front of the pyramids with this helmet that a lot of people thought was inappropriate because it invoked colonialist sentiments and that kind of thing. But compared to other first ladies, for example, when I went to Africa covering Melania Trump, the one first lady that most Africans still continue to talk about was Laura Bush, because she carried with her this huge program of PEPFAR. This is a program to eradicate HIV/AIDS in the continent, which was very, very successful. So again, these kind of first ladies visits, they do amplify the administration's policies wherever they go. So in that sense, Jill Biden was able to show both herself as a first lady, bringing a message of hope, but also at the same time, amplify what her husband administration is trying to do in Africa.
It's interesting that we talked about PEPFAR, and PEPFAR is perhaps the number one thing that both Americans and people from Africa point to as far as the U.S.'s biggest success in Africa. And that's been about 20 years ago. President Biden has made Africa a priority. He had African leaders to Washington last year, and this year he's already sent out his Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, his Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. They've already made trips to Africa. Jill Biden is the first lady, the next one now to have gone to Africa. Eventually, President Biden and Vice President Harris will make trips to Africa later this year. It is part of a deliberate campaign by President Biden to try and engage African nations, mostly as a counterweight to China's influence and Russia's influence in Africa. If you take a look at the UN resolution that was offered up last week, it was a non-binding resolution calling on the General Assembly to get Russia out of Ukraine. 32 nations abstained from this resolution. Half of the 32 that abstained are from Africa. And that's because there's a lot of Russian influence in Africa, as well as a lot of Chinese influence in Africa. So the United States is trying to play catch up and trying to engage the 54 nations in Africa for American investment, as well as American influence.
And absolutely. And, you know, part of it is to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is so prevalent in Africa. I mean, I remember being shocked when I was in Malawi, when I saw all the signs at the airports, both had English, Malawi, and also Chinese characters. So, you know, you cannot understate the Chinese reach in terms of investments as well as political influence in Africa.
Yes, absolutely. Well, in our last topic, Afghanistan's government's watchdog for reconstruction revealed that the U.S. helped lay the groundwork for the quick fall of the country when U.S. troops left Afghanistan in August 2021. So, Patsy, how has the U.S. responded to this report?
So this is a report that came out of SIGAR, which is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, that was tasked to examine what happened at the fall of the Afghan government and the withdrawal of the American forces from Afghanistan. And it really just confirms a lot of the reporting of VOA and others that says this kind of abrupt and uncoordinated pullout in August of 2021, the kind of like American weaponry that was left behind, it really became something that gave the Taliban a lot of power. It was really a failure to create this kind of independent and self-sustainable security force in Afghanistan after 20 years and what, like something to the tune of $90 billion of international support, right? So the White House is not saying much about the report. We haven't really been able to ask them. We've been trying to ask them for a response to this report, but basically, you know, they like to highlight the fact that what they did throughout the withdrawal was they were able to rescue American forces and rescue as many Afghans allies as possible through this, you know, massive airlift operations that happened right after the fall of Kabul. So there's really not a lot that the administration can say. There's a lot of criticism that were targeted towards them. And don't forget that we're still also waiting for the review to come out of both the State Department as well as the Pentagon to learn the lessons of what happened with the withdrawal.
The withdrawal from Afghanistan began politically a fraught political environment for President Biden. It happened during his first year in office. And if you take a look at Biden's political approval rating, you can see that the beginning of the withdrawal from Afghanistan also began a precipitous fall in President Biden's approval rating to the point where he is now approaching the point as far as approval now almost a year plus later, now approaching a level where he almost was back after he was elected. So the withdrawal from Afghanistan not only was in the eyes of the Special Inspector General as lessons that can be learned, but not optimistic that the United States will learn them. It's also been a political yoke around President Biden's neck that he still really hasn't been able to get out from under. Whether or not that will hang with him for the rest of his presidency is yet to be seen, but it was a big challenge in his first year. He followed through on a promise from his predecessor to withdraw from Afghanistan, and neither he nor the United States have really been able to bounce back from that so far.
Okay, well, it's time now to find out what is weighing on the minds of our panelists this week. Patsy, what is weighing on your mind this week?
I'm thinking a lot about the national cybersecurity strategy that the White House released on Thursday. It's very, very aggressive. It's pushing for more to keep the online realm safer, but it really shifts cybersecurity responsibilities from us to industry. So they're really trying to place the burden on them, on the software industry, the computer industry, to systems industry, to develop these kind of like secure by design products that are designed to reduce the number of flaws before they're introduced to the market. That's number one. And the number two is that they're going to be much more aggressively pursuing ransomware actors, cybersecurity threats, and treating it as a national security threat rather than, you know, a criminal enterprise. So I thought these two developments are super interesting because past administrations have had no cybersecurity strategy before, but this is by far the most aggressive and the most muscular.
Thank you. And Steve?
I am still jealous of the photos that I saw from my friends out in Los Angeles of snow out in LA. They rarely get any snow in Los Angeles. I'm an East Coast guy, a product of the Northeast of the United States. Winter has meant snow for me for more than 60 years. And we haven't had any snow yet. Maybe I'm obsessed with the weather, too obsessed with climate change, but the fact that we haven't had any measurable snow here in Washington, D.C. all winter long and probably will not get any more snow through the rest of the month of March and into April, that's what is concerning me and where we're headed as far as the world's climate is what is weighing on my mind this week.
Well, my son would agree with you, Steve, because he's upset that there are no snow days where he can stay home and play video games. But obviously, I share your concern about climate change. But honestly, as a tropical girl, I'm happy not to have to shovel snow. Sorry.
Well, I happen to be a snow person, so I do miss the fact that we...
All right, I'm outvoted.
Well, that's all the time we have, and we'll close on those thoughts. My thanks to our panelists, VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Whitaker-Zwara and VOA Executive Producer Steve Reddish. I'm Kim Lewis, and join us next week for more Issues in the News.